Welcome back to Beyond the Cattle Grid, a podcast from the West Highland Museum by Chris Robinson. Last time we made our way from bustling Fort William up the hill to Blaemar Foulchoch. Having released the podcast, I was struck by doubts. Was it all true? I should have had it checked by a real local up from Blaemar. So I spoke to Dorothy Fraser, who I'd worked with for many years. Dorothy was born Dorothy Kennedy, and since she has spoken to her two sisters, and between them confirmed that all the tales are true, and between them they've offered me many more tales from above the cattle grid. The other generous teller of tales are Ian and Anne McColl, who live in the farmhouse just at the top of the brae. Ian came with his parents to Lochaber in 1942, living in the house off to the left, just down a bit from the brow of the hill. Ian, with his son Col, still work the farm, and between the generations, the family have been farming the hill for 80 years, about Blaemar Foulchoch and beyond. But back to Dorothy, who was born at Blaemar Foulchoch, the second youngest of 11, and was one of the last few pupils in the school there. When it closed in the early 60s, she'd only been 2 years at the school, and was devastated. She'd be going to the school in the town. The family were born in the same stone house that her father, Donald Kennedy, was born and brought up in. And her mother, Jessie Cameron, was born in a corrugated croft house along the road, past Katie Cameron's house and Ian McColl's, and down the metal track off to the left. This lane leads past a sheep fank to a spot where one Erskine Beveridge took the picture in about 1880, which heads this podcast. Erskine Beveridge was a successful businessman and linen manufacturer from Dunfermline, who wandered all over the Highlands in the last years of the 1800s taking pictures. Many of these pictures were published after his death in 1922, but one in particular was used as the front cover of a more recently published book by the Royal Commission of Ancient Monuments entitled Wanderings with a Camera. This croft house seen in the picture, Dorothy tells me, was probably the home of a Hugh Mackenzie. You see a bearded, shirt-sleeved gentleman standing proudly outside the door with a rubble wall and haystacks about. Some years ago I went looking for that house, clutching that picture, and lining up the outlines of the hills in the background. I walked to the spot where I was sure the picture was taken, and what was there? Nothing, apart from a low bank and a stand of mature trees behind. Where was the low wall? Where was the house? Clearly stones gather no moss in Blaemar Foulchoch. The stones that built that house have moved. Before they were in the picture, they would have been in a wall or a byre decades or centuries before, and now they've moved off again for their next supporting role. Hugh Mackenzie loved a visit from the Kennedy children, and he had a gramophone which they would ask him to wind up again and again so they could dance to the music. Dorothy's father, Donald Kennedy, had to take over their croft at the tender age of 12 when his father was killed after an accident when his horse and cart rolled over him. Donald was a hard worker and had to learn many skills quickly, and one of these was shoeing the horses, which he did for the neighbouring crofters. A tale Donald often told the family was one winter's night when, out at the stable feeding the horses, he was struck by some strange lights about the horses' tails, like a halo. He told his wife about this, who quickly dismissed this as his suggestion of anything strange about this apparition, and he thought no more until the next day they awoke to find that there had been a heavy fall of snow overnight. There had been a death in the community, and the funeral was arranged for that day. The hearse was organised but couldn't get up the road because of the snow. Needs must, and Donald Kennedy came to the rescue and employed his two horses, Tommy and Meg, to take the deceased to his final resting place. What of the lights? The neat, whitewashed and immaculate barn beside Ian's new house was once the home of one Baldy Mitchell, Donald Kennedy's uncle, a rough and ready but very kindly bachelor who lived at one end of the house while his cattle occupied the other end. Normal practice in the old Highlands, but unusual at the time of Dorothy's youth. When she and her siblings passed the house, Baldy would call them in to offer some boiled sweets he kept in a deep pocket in his working clothes. Some hesitation regarding the cleanliness of the offering was soon overcome. "When the sweets tasted just great," said Dorothy. Dorothy's mother, Jessie Cameron, a native of Blamafulchook, went up the peat track with Neil MacLeod on Nevis Radio about 25 years ago. Up the peat track was Neil's local interpretation of Desert Island Discs, but moor and mountain instead of blue skies and sunshine. Jessie talked of the 30 crofts that there once were at Blamafulchook, but as folk died off, crofts were amalgamated, and there were only 4 crofts left at the time of her interview. She went to the local school until she was 12, when she walked the 4 miles to school each day after milking the cows before she left. She was lucky, though, to have a bursary and was able to live in the girls' hostel in Fort William during the winter. After her marriage, she and Donald lived off the croft, but some cash came in from his contract maintaining the 4 miles of road from the cattle grid through to Lundervar Farm road end. The road was then just as General Wade left it, no tarmac, just a stony track. He kept it open, filling in the holes and digging the drainage ditches. Donald also did extra sheep work, gathering, dipping and shearing, for Donald Cameron, Glen Nevis. And the days he was away, he left Jessie to run the croft, feeding the animals, haymaking and tending crofts. Many a day he would come home to see the huge field he had spent the previous day cutting with a scythe had been miraculously turned into rows and rows of neat little mounds called praypacks, small hayrucks, erected by Jessie and assisted by the children. Jessie often walked from the town with a huge rucksack on her back, sometimes heavily pregnant. And Dorothy remembered Mrs. Hobbs of Inverlochy Castle, who would organise a ceilidh in the schoolhouse to celebrate the old new year. It was attended by the whole community, and she supplied the most delicious food. One thing remembered was huge bowls of jelly and trifle. In these days, a rare treat indeed. Quite often, a gentleman of the road or a tramp would call in looking for work, food or shelter for the night in one of the barns. Kate remembered a fellow who called the Kennedy the Kennedy family were lifting potatoes. He arrived on an old bike, which was unusual, but he seemed very polite and friendly, and he rolled up his sleeves to help. The kids had great fun with him, throwing rotten potatoes and teasing him, which he all took in good humour. He was fed and given a blanket and a place in the barn, and when offered breakfast, told Jessie he would need to be away very, very early, as he was heading through to Kinlochleven. Next day, before 6, Jessie gave him a bowl of porridge, tea and a piece to take away with him. But not long after he left, cycling away on the old rickety bike, the police arrived, asking if the family had seen a man of the same description. When Jessie and Donald confirmed he'd been in the barn for the night, the police told them he was extremely dangerous and was on the run from Barlinnie, and the bike was stolen from a garden in Lundervar Road. The charming guest obviously had a lot of hidden secrets. Donald and Jessie took in boarded-out children who had been orphaned during the war and gave them a home in the country. A brother and sister, Jock and Mary Gillis, were just like part of the family and worked hard on the croft. Electricity came late to Blamafulchook, even though it was being generated in the township, but it wired its way down to Fort William, leaving tilly lamps to heat and light the houses. After the end of the Second World War, a power line was constructed through the hill to Onick, and those that could afford it had power, but many could not, particularly with the extra cost of having to have their houses wired. But that didn't stop Jessie watching television. She had a wee TV powered by a car battery. And every week Dorothy took the battery away to her house to recharge it. Jessie carefully rationed her viewing of the news, so there was enough power to see each nightly episode of Take the High Road right through to the end of the week. It wasn't until the EEC provided funding in the 70s that Donald and Jesse Kennedy had a light switch, running hot water and TV at the flick of a switch. But we'll head off down the road a few yards and look over into the field on the right, where a 6-foot diameter erratic boulder is in the middle of the field. But we'll come back to that. The steep brae leads down to a wee twist in the road over a concrete bridge and then uphill again. And along to the left, in an open, gated, tarred road, we're led to Ian McCall's cattle sheds and the house of Blarachuran. Walk to the right past the house and across the little footbridge on the left over the burn into an open field with a fenced, wooded knoll over to the left, which is the graveyard. The knoll was possibly a glacial came built from a cone of little stones, left from when a trickle of water fell down inside the 4,000-foot-high glacier, which once froze and rose here. The stones gathered just as a tiny cone of fine sand heaps up in the bottom of an old upturned 4-minute egg timer. But this heap is probably took 4,000 years to arise from the valley floor. A plaque on the gate warns of a war grave, and if we straggle up the steep grass to the top of the knoll, we find the grave. Hugh Cameron, aforementioned, who died aged 18, of the black measles at Colchester. To remind you, the gravestone reads, H. Cameron, Private 2172, First Lovett Scouts, who died Friday, 26th of March, 1915, aged 18. Alongside are his brother Alan, of the New Year Bottle, and sisters Bella, Rachel and of course Katie. Katie lamented in life that she would be the last of many hundreds of Camerons from Blamafulchuk in that graveyard, and probably the very last person to be buried there. There will be tales to tell in that hillock if only we knew. There is one more recent stone, a memorial stone to Fred Van Vos and his colourful wife Thea, who owned the estate of Blarachuran, who died within a few days of each other in 2010. Fred's family have humbly placed their stone, not as the king of the castle, but low down by the fence, perhaps in respect of the many hundreds of natives who lie above. In the early 1800s, there were 800 people living about Blamafulchuk. Most will have been buried here without recognition. Times were hard, and every patch of fertile good ground would have been keeping mouths fed and too important to lie fallow as a cemetery. Few folk visit this graveyard, but Hugh receives an annual visit from the War Graves Commission, who cut the grass and clean his stone. And at the bottom of the knoll from the entrance is a slab which Ian McCall told me, which he said marks the grave of a local shepherd, who chose this stone as it lay on the track towards Kinlochleven. Over years, whilst fit and able and out working, he would carry his heavy Calvary headstone a few yards at a time towards the graveyard and its final resting place where they both now lie. Beyond the graveyard on the right, a low bank reveals a corn kiln at its east end, but more dramatic is an unnamed stone resting on a high bank in the field straight ahead. Over a shallow gully carrying a burn with a wire fence above it, but perhaps easier to walk down the track into the field, crossing the burn, through the gate and follow the fence uphill. There's first the outline of a sizeable old croft house, but just beyond, a large boulder carries about 20 shallow cup marks, the most impressive in Lochaber. They seem to have slipped from local memory until I stumbled across a few lines in an article in the Transactions of the Geological Society of Glasgow in 1900 by one Colin Livingston, local headmaster, about boulders in Lochaber. My son David and I headed up to Blar, and after examining innumerable boulders, a black Blarahurin, we found the one we were looking for. There, on the top of a large rock about 8 feet long and 3 feet high, just inside the fence, are about 20 cup marks. Cup marks are of Neolithic origin, 5,000 years old, and there are few in Lough Aber. Later versions were cup and ring marks, and there are many down Kilmartin way south of Oban. They were made by grinding a hard rock into the surface of a rock face or boulder to leave a hollow depression, sometimes up to an inch in depth. Must have taken a long time. So there were folk working away at this up here at Blamafortchuk 2,000 years before the pyramids were built. Mayor Hool from Lough Aber is currently working with the Scottish Rock Art Project, recording all the cup marks in Scotland, thousands of them, in fine detail to see if any patterns emerge which could explain the reason why these people spent so many hours making them. There's another at Arisaig and another near the auction mart in the wood, which I haven't seen yet. Colin Livingstone, whose writings led me to rediscover the cut marks, was the headmaster in Fort William School of its day and lived in Avondale in Cameron Road, Fort William. He did not just confine himself to his educational responsibilities. He laid out the line of the path up Ben Nevis for the observatory in 1883 and accompanied several geologists around Lough Aber, identifying the evidence of the action of ice. He was a curler and something of a polymath. However, his pupils may not have been so appreciative of his extracurricular activities. One of them wrote many years later,
"Master was a man of scientific leanings and vivid imagination, but he had no great gift of instruction. One who was disposed to learn might learn from him, but his temper was a terror to his pupils. There was a verse in honour of the Tors, of all things. This piece of old leather, some call this the Tors, whilst used by old Colin to sanction his laws. There was no doubt need for its use sometimes, but it was used far too often for good discipline." I found one other cut mark at Blamafortchuk on that big stone in the field below Ian McCall's house. You have to climb on top of that boulder to see it properly. Mayer has now recorded all these cut marks. The rocks around Blamafortchuk are primarily hard schists in which are bands of limestone and slate. Good grass and grazing are found on the limestone, whilst the slates, though not of great quality, have been quarried at the roadside just beyond the track to Blarahurin on the left. Beyond this field and into the forestry lies the bewooded lost village of Tolly. The trees were at head height when I went there 30 years ago. There was just a few gable ends. They'll still be there, but only a few know how to get there and get back out again in the dense plantation. They remain deep in the wood as yet undisturbed until the day the trees come down, when all will be revealed. Back on the road in a twisting mile, we see on the left the remains of an old once slated house. The house was intact and the roof still there in 1976. But the stones and the wall have moved on just as they do. And the fine lintel is bearing weight again in a house much closer to the town. In that house once lived Peggy McLennan, later Oliver, whose father had had to leave Lochan in Glenkinney for his children to be educated. She later stayed at Drumsally Mill and was known about Glenfinnan as Peggy the Mill before marrying George Oliver and emigrating to Canada. Much later in life, they both returned to Lough Aber, unhoused, living in a small caravan at Glenfinnan. And when George died, ageing Peggy had a house in nearby Cool. She was a tall, white-haired, engaging woman with a presence. She seemed to gather round her helpers like moths to a candle, and she was forever thankful to all these helpers, but nevertheless left one with a feeling, as I remember seeing in my school report, could do better. On one occasion, when Peggy was decrying the inadequacies of the United Kingdom's National Health Service and threatening to return to Canada, I asked her what she said to her doctors there. "Oh, it's easy," she said. I tell them things are so bad here, I think I'll have to head back to Scotland. On the roadside is a standing stone which once supported the gate of the toll house, probably with another house adjacent. There's a deep pool below a waterfall in the River Caithness just down from that stone, which was a regular outing for the Robinson family after school or at weekends on sunny summer days. And we always stopped on the way back to search for gold. Embedded but protruding from the hard schist on the roadside are tiny cubes of iron pyrites, fool's gold, but still collected from the ditch below the rock and treasured in a jam jar back home on the bedroom windowsill. Our secret gold mine, however, was no more. When the gold rush at Blamafortric was splashed on the front page of the Lochaber News, with a large picture of Gus MacDonald, the pigman, and a neighbour panning for gold in the burn by the concrete bridge. But it was the 1st of April. Well, third one's coming quite soon. Look forward to a clash between Campbell's and MacDonald's. An embarrassing sequel to a boxing tournament. And a discovery at the Inverlochy Women's Royal Institute. Hope to see you then. Goodbye.